This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In the age of the internet, it sometimes seems as though there are no great mysteries left. Any question you have can be answered with a quick Google search. But for Stephen Reynolds, mystery is at the heart of his work. Reynolds is a professor of physics at North Carolina State University. His specialties are relativity and astrophysics. He deals with the stuff of creation, supernovas, the explosion of stars, the very oven that bakes, the stuff of stuff. Out there in the universe, there are still many mysteries, and people like Stephen Reynolds are the pioneers charting the frontier of the 21st century. Stephen Reynolds joins us now in our studio. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Nice to be here.
What are some of the mysteries facing astrophysicists today?
Well, one that I'm particularly interested in has to do with the nature of one kind of supernova, since you mentioned supernovae. Supernovae are exploding stars. That's always a cool thing. Most stars don't do this, but the ones that do make a critical contribution to the nature of the universe that we live in. One kind in particular, so-called type 1A supernovae, are the explosions of white dwarf stars in binary systems. So these are stars that would, in isolation, just be stellar corpses, what our sun is going to turn into in about 5 billion years. But if they have a close companion, it's possible that the burned-out cinder that is the white dwarf can be reignited in a titanic explosion. These kinds of explosions are responsible for most of the iron that's created in the universe. And along with the other kind of supernova, core collapse supernovae, are responsible for the creation of most of the heavy elements in the periodic table, heavier than iron. So gold, silver, platinum, uranium, all of these things, these elements, every atom was forged in a supernova somewhere. The type 1A supernovae, the exploding white dwarfs, are mysterious to this point. We don't really understand how you get a white dwarf to blow up. And the answering that question has a lot to do with when the universe started getting seeded with iron and heavy elements like that, the kinds of things that are necessary to make planets and astronomers. So their nature is a really critical question.
You've just raised a lot of questions I'd never considered before. So you say most stars don't blow up. I guess I'd never really, I always thought that they were all on the same trajectory. It's just a matter of time. But some do, some don't, huh?
Absolutely not. The most important thing about a star is its mass, just the total amount of stuff in it. The vast majority of stars are relatively low-mass stars, and they quietly putter along in their lives, turning hydrogen into helium in their cores. And they'll eventually basically run out of fuel in the center and just kind of slowly die out. One kind of curious thing, this is, astronomy is full of zingers, and when I'm teaching students who are not science students, it's fun to bring these out. So the universe is incomparably larger than the Earth, say. But it's only three times as old as the Earth. The universe is relatively young by that standard. In fact, the lower mass stars, which turn out to live their lives much more slowly than high mass stars, have not had time since the universe began to finish their evolution. So that's one interesting question. It's completely apart from my own research. Could we find some of that very first primal generation of stars somewhere if we look hard enough? At any rate, the more massive the star, the faster it lives its life. And the stars born with about eight times the mass of the sun and higher, which are a very small percentage of stars, those are the ones that will blow up in so-called core collapse supernovae. Most of the other stars will turn out to be these white dwarf stars, and most of those are isolated and will simply cool out for the rest of the universe unless they meet some conditions that we don't completely understand.
And so and they're the ones, are just the white dwarfs or all of the exploding, all of the supernova, all those that explode, responsible for these heavy metals and iron, et cetera?
All supernovae.
So they all are. And so we don't quite know yet whether there's a superabundance of those materials that leads to their blowing up, or the fact is that when they blow up, that's where we get our stuff, and that's what we
know. But it's clear that, the stars produce the material, because the very first stars had nothing but hydrogen and helium. That's another mystery. What were those stars like?
Wow. So this is the stuff you're working on. When you got to NC State, you were the first PhD with in astrophysics in your department. Is that right?
That's right. In fact, I hadn't even applied when 1985. I'd finished a couple of postdocs. It was time to get serious and get a real job. There were about 10 potentially permanent positions in the U.S. at that time. Rough way to go. But NC State was one. But they weren't advertising for an astronomer. They just advertised the new faculty member in physics. And I looked them up and realized that they didn't have any astronomy, so I wrote them off. But an NC State grad who had gotten a PhD from MIT in astrophysics and was on the faculty at University of Virginia, where I was, said, "No, Reynolds, look, they're trying to expand and diversify. You ought to apply and be a pioneer." So I did, and they hired me, and I was. And as I say, it was a little lonely for the first few years, but there's now 9 of us on the faculty, and we're all busy churning out papers and students.
Astrophysics, where is it in terms of the hierarchy of importance or the attention that that physicists give the world of science? How important is it to us these days?
Well, I think it depends on the audience. Clearly, there are some people for whom very applied physics is absolutely critical, because that's going to be what determines the hardware that you buy in the superstores in 5 years. And we have people at NC State working on that, working on condensed matter physics. And then there's the less applied kinds, which are just answering fundamental questions. And I think most people believe that it's important to have both kinds, but people's priorities are different. In an applied university like NC State, sometimes folks wonder, what's the role of astrophysics? I'm in the field because I like it, and I'm in astrophysics in particular because it uses all kinds of physics, and so it's really a kind of personal enjoyment. But these are questions that are important to people. So one way of judging the relative importance, when I'm on an airplane and the person next to me asks what I do, I have to decide if I want to have a conversation or not. If I don't, I say I'm a physicist, and that will pretty much end it. The person will say, oh, I hated physics, and that will be the end of the conversation. Yeah. If I want to talk, I say I'm an astronomer. And all of a sudden, that opens all kinds of doors, and people are fascinated. So I go around and I give talks to normal people, including taxpayers whose taxes support me at NC State. And I find a really great fascination with the nature of the universe and the things in it. And from that point of view, I think astrophysics is a pretty important part of what we do.
How did you get interested? When did you first decide or become interested in science and math?
Well, my father was an electrical engineer, and I had always done well in math. I was interested in astronomy on and off, but really just math and science in general, all the way until I got to college. Even then, I wasn't totally certain what I wanted to do. So I looked at various options, and it seemed like they all required that you begin with physics. So I started in physics. I had the benefit of some tremendous teachers my first few semesters, and physics was so great that I never left. Now, the sub-discipline of astrophysics I picked in graduate school. It was finally time to get serious and zero in on something. And again, because I liked all of the different kinds of physics, I picked the area in which those are mostly involved. I mean, I can't dismiss anything in astrophysics. I have to know solid-state physics and nuclear physics and plasma physics and fluid dynamics and all kinds of things, and that's one of the great enjoyments for me.
Well, the other part of astrophysics, it seems to me, that sets it apart is that that's where the realm of the spiritual and the scientific and the material actually come together, at least in the speculative mind. That's what gets us, even if you didn't know physics, speculating about origins. Where did it start? And you hardly ever ask where without and how without blundering into why, whether it's a relevant question to physicists. Was that any part of it for you, sort of the bigger unanswerable questions, or certainly unanswered questions?
Well, I don't think I was really motivated by the sort of mystical component, but I was certainly motivated by wanting to understand the biggest picture that there was, and that is the whole universe. What do we know about it? What can we say about it from evidence? And one of the great things about astrophysics is that questions that people absolutely thought were completely metaphysical have moved into the realm of science. So as recently as the 19th century, a French philosopher said it would be impossible in principle ever to learn the age of the Earth. Well, that's just wrong, as it turned out. We've discovered some things, and we now know the age of the Earth to about less than 1%. So wanting to see the largest possible stage was certainly a motivation for me. And that does impact my worldview, not really in any sort of theological way, but in a sense of perspective. It's really hard to get too anxious about being done out of a parking space by some obnoxious driver if when I get to spend all of my time thinking about vastly longer length scales and time scales. And it just, it's a useful perspective. And I find that it helps me level out.
How old is the Earth?
About 4.5 billion years, 4.6 billion years.
And that's interesting. So that would, by your reckoning, then some of the universe itself then 12, 13 billion years.
That's right. Actually, we know to amazing precision now. And one of the reasons, we didn't plan this, but it comes right back to type 1A supernovae. This kind of supernova is very bright and very uniform, which means that when one goes off anywhere in the universe, you can identify it by certain properties, you know its intrinsic brightness. So if it looks really, really faint, the only way that can be is if it's really, really far away. So by judging the brightness of these type 1A supernovae, we have been able to chart the universe with unprecedented accuracy, including the fact, as you're probably aware, the universe is expanding. We all knew this. In graduate school, I was taught the big important question was, how fast was it expanding and how fast was it slowing down due to the gravity of everything pulling on everything else? Well, we now know the answer to the first question, how fast is it expanding, quite accurately. The second question wasn't even the right question. The universe's expansion is not slowing down at all. It is speeding up. This was the greatest scientific surprise of my lifetime, and I guess of yours too, though you may not have known it.
No, I still thought it was possible that this whole thing was going to cave in on me any minute now, including right. when I took your parking place.
That's right. Yeah, the big crunch is what people used to call. Everything would fall back together. Well, not going to happen.
On the State of Things today, talking to Stephen Reynolds, physics professor at NC State University. You're listening to the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. More of our conversation to come. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today talking with NC State physics professor Stephen Reynolds. You talked about your interest in science and math growing up, and I understand you grew up in, or for a while at least, living in Brazil, right?
That's correct. My father moved to a little rural town called São José dos Campos, 1953, as part of a phalanx of foreign professors invited to come in and help start off what was designed to be a brand new university technical school in Brazil, modeled on MIT and Caltech, called the Instituto Tecnológico de Aeronáutica, or ITA. And it has really turned out to be one of the world's top technical institutes. But my father was one of the first class of folks. He dragged his whole family, including me, age three, to São José, and I was unceremoniously deposited in what was supposed to be a Brazilian nursery school. There was a school for American children. Fortunately, I was too young to be in it. It turned out that the nursery school teacher was quite ferocious. She taught her charges how to read and write in Portuguese. So it turned out I was suddenly literate.
And you weren't even, she wasn't supposed to be teaching in Portuguese, right?
No, she was sacked eventually, but the damage was done. And from my knowledge of Portuguese literacy, apparently, my mother tells me I was able to learn to read English too.
Well, so you learned Portuguese first. We
that's
are three.
Right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, that's pretty great. Well, there's some great Portuguese navigators who, before the stars were the goal, were plying the seas. You also learned music, and you're very interested in music. Tell us about that and how your interest in music developed.
Well, my father was a very good musician and basically played professionally in a small kind of way, belonged to the Musicians Union. In college, he had played in dance bands and played clarinet and saxophone. And he and my mother, when they were younger, used to listen to a lot of music. So they had a big library of LPs. But they had kind of gotten out of the way. We kids came along, and that put paid to their free time. My father moved back to the States in 1956. We moved to Seattle. He wanted to live on the water, so we had a nice house on Puget Sound. I was back in school, and in the third grade, every school child in Seattle was tested for hearing. My hearing acuity was very good, and I brought home a note that said I should be started on a stringed instrument. So they cast around and found a violin that some relative had and put me on that, and so I took lessons for a year or two and played the usual drivel that you do when you're starting to play. But a transformative experience. When I was in the fifth grade, my teacher put on a recording of a Leonard Bernstein Young People's Concert in which he analyzed the first movement of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. and pointed out that it was made of a little musical germ, a little idea which was then propagated and developed and turned into things. And there was something that even I could pick up and listen for, and music was structured and organized. And I went home that day, insisted that my parents haul out the store of recordings, and for the next several years, every day as I came home from school, I'd listen to music for 1 or 2 hours. And suddenly it made sense to play the violin. And at that point, I became self-motivated, and the miserable job of practicing I was willing to put up with. And so I got to be quite a serious violinist.
How old were you when this happened?
Let's see. I guess 9.
Wow. And so this idea of theme and variation and the development of the idea that you can take a couple of notes, two of which are repeated, and then turn it over and over again. And in a way, I mean, isn't that what physics is about? I mean, you know, you've got a couple of tiny, tiny little things, and there aren't many of them in kind, and then they develop, redevelop, they form, reform, burn, melt, and fly, and there you have it, a universe full of vastly various material.
Well, certainly starting small is one of the great attractions for me. Physics is getting a long way from simple basic principles. Now, certainly it's true that the highly organized quality of Western classical music appeals to people in math and science. There's absolutely no doubt about it. Often people take this a little too far and talk about some fundamental connection between them. Well, it's a one-way connection. Your average musician doesn't tend to have a passion for physics. But it's no doubt about it. It's the favorite art form of people in science. And I'm not sure exactly what the appeal, the regularity. When I took composition classes in college, the fact that you could really zero in, you could say, this phrase isn't working very well. Why don't you try this different note? And the discrete range of pitches instead of, say, an infinite range of colors, I think made it amenable to analysis in a way that analysis of visual arts isn't.
Was it true that you at one point worked on the score for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? Was it the film?
I did. I played in that orchestra. It was just a bunch of freelancers in the Bay Area. Most movie soundtracks are recorded in L.A., but that movie was an independent studio. It was owned by Fantasy Records in Berkeley. So they just went out and hired an orchestra of locals, and I got to play on it. And, boy, that one hit the big time. The director's cut DVD just came out a year or two ago, and I got another check. They're still paying me for that session in 1975.
Had you read the book? Did you know what you were playing for?
I did, actually.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it was great.
I've got a clip, actually, of you playing one of your songs. Now, this is not from the soundtrack to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, but this is you playing the violin. Stephen Reynolds playing the violin, my guest this hour, now a physics professor at NC State. With those open cadences, it's hard to know where to fade out because you can just keep going around and around and around. So had you considered at one point, were you thinking about a career in music, or was this always a sideline for you?
Well, I realized in high school that it was probably going to be easier to be a professional physicist than an amateur musician than a professional musician and an amateur scientist. And I also had my father's example. So he played a regular job with a dance band once a month for his whole career as a professor of electrical engineering at the University of Washington. So that was a model for me. In graduate school, I did get quite serious. And at the University of California, Berkeley is where I was. I joined the Musicians Union Local 6, AF of M, and played in the Oakland Symphony, San Francisco Ballet Orchestra. So after I got my master's degree, I took a year off. The only way I could play in the ballet, because they rehearsed during the day, unlike the Oakland Symphony, was if I wasn't in school. So I took a year off between the master's and proceeding, and was basically a full-time musician. So I got to see what the life of a second-rate freelancer was like. And, I got... played all kinds of things, played rock concerts. I backed up Paul Anka and
The Violin on Having My Baby?
Go back that far. By that time, he was just a Las Vegas. So I really did get a chance to see what that was like. But I always knew that it probably wasn't going to be something. My gifts were not such as would carry me to the really, position in one of the top 20 orchestras. And so it would be a matter of always, while I was a freelancer, I'd spend as much time in a car as I did in sessions. We drove all over the Bay Area, drove from San Jose to Santa Rosa and, drive 2 hours for a 2-hour session, drive 2 hours back. It was, I knew a lot of people, young people who seemed to enjoy that. I expect as they got older, it got less fun.
It gets to be less fun. You still playing now a little bit?
Yeah, well, that recording, by the way, the pianist on that was my good friend, Content Sublinski, who's been on the faculty of University of Virginia for many years. And we were playing a little bit from the introduction and the Preludium and Allegro by Fritz Kreisler. That was from a recital I gave just a couple years ago at NC State. So I do try to keep my hand in, but it's certainly not like it was.
So when you talked about the life of a musician, you have to travel a lot. I guess the good news about astrophysics these days, unlike it earlier in the trajectory of that industry, you don't have to go to telescopes anymore. All the information's available and it comes to you. You can kind of sit at a screen. How important is it to actually be eyeballing this stuff these days?
Well, eyeballing, even at the big telescopes, look through the telescope, you look at a screen. And so actually, the fact that we don't travel so much, that's correct. I'm not sure if that's a bug or a feature. Earlier in my career, I was a radio astronomer for a few years and actually got to travel out to the Very Large Array in New Mexico. And there's really a great feeling about being in some remote, isolated place with just you and the universe. But it's true. That's pretty much gone away. And in fact, my own interests have moved more toward X-ray astronomy. And for that, you need to get above the atmosphere because cosmic X-rays don't get through the atmosphere. That's why we're people and not reduced to primordial slime by the radiation. So NASA has several, and other countries have outstanding orbiting observatories. And of course, the only way you can get the information is through the computer. So I can sit at my desk, I can submit my proposals for observing time. I get the data back at my desk. I never have to leave my desk. Just with a knife feed and a catheter, I could spend my whole life sitting at my desk.
And maybe a fiddle just to pass the time if it gets a little, dull. And where did the what now? We talked about some of the big problems that that you're working on. I think of NC State too as a lot of technology and particularly applied science. So where is NC State in all of this? Because you're doing some primary, some original basic research in astrophysics, right?
Well, it's true. And the group that we've hired, we have overlapping interests in supernovae. My own interests led me initially from the remnants, the expanding gas clouds left behind after supernovae, a field called supernova remnants, and closer to the explosions themselves. But we've also added some people in nuclear astrophysics who worry in detail about how the elements are synthesized. Various overlapping areas. So we have a common interest in that area, and we've been beginning to get some notice. Actually, by now, there are maybe 5 or 6 groups of researchers on the planet as comparable to ours in the field of supernovae. So just in May, this last May, we had an international conference with about 130 people from all over the world, the world's experts on supernovae in Raleigh, in Riddick Hall, giving talks and arguing with each other and having a good time. So we've managed to get on. So people who had never heard of NC State in the field of astronomers now know that that's something that we do. So we're a big university, and we ought to do many things. And slowly the word gets out that, in fact, it's not just about the traditional strengths of the university, which are still present. It's certainly a great engineering school, great school for agriculture and life sciences, but it's turning out to be very strong in other areas too. So we're contributing to, a broadening of the perception of the university.
And when we talk about the basic research, are you getting at sort of the nature of matter itself? It's not sort of to answer the big metaphysical questions, which they say in some ways that's where these big ideas come together. The metaphysics and the science can at least mingle up in the realm of astrophysics. But is the basic stuff of astrophysics looking at the nature of matter itself?
Well, we're all extremely highly specialized. There are astrophysical kinds of evidence that bear on, say, particle physics and the nature of the structure of matter. For instance, neutron stars, they're the densest kind of thing before the last stop before a black hole. Basically, the mass of the sun in something that's maybe 10 miles across, unbelievably dense. The nature of, so these things are, we observe these, well, we don't, we observe them indirectly in space. If they have strong magnetic fields and spin, then they may be pulsars that emit regular radio blips. And we can try to learn astrophysically what their sizes are exactly. And that turns out to be connected to nuclear physics and the deep structure of nuclei, which is what matter is made of. So there are certainly some connections. And some people work in parts of astrophysics that are a lot closer. We also have an indirect tie in that this charting the universe business that I was telling you about, mainly done through the Type 1a supernovae, requires that we understand those supernovae pretty well, because we really don't want to make mistakes because we assumed, for instance, I said they were very similar to one another, but they're not identical. So in a sense, understanding the Type 1a supernovae is sharpening the tools that you use to get at one of the biggest questions in all of science, which is what's driving this acceleration of the expansion of the universe.
Well, and I wanted to pick up on that, because you said that, first of all, you surprised me. There's no chance now that we'll come back on ourselves. So I haven't been keeping up with the journals. Forgive me. But the other part of this is that stuff is going to, what, fall off the edge of the universe?
Essentially, the expansion can get so fast that light cannot reach us from those objects. Now, you learned in school that nothing can go faster than light. And that's true. I can't pass you going faster than the speed of light. But space itself can stretch you and me apart, so that light cannot get from you to me. That it's possible. And this is on very, very long cosmological length scales, not on 2-meter scales. But if the acceleration continues without cease, as appears to be the case at the moment, then eventually that will happen, that things even first millions of light years apart will cease to be visible to each other, and then hundreds of thousands, and then tens of thousands, and ultimately space itself will be torn apart. Well, now, that's a pretty big extrapolation from where we are now, but that's the idea.
Well, I almost cried. It's a very lonely universe at that point, when we can't even see each other anymore, even
that
the things
is correct.
We speculate about. But so what happened to the light? Did it just sort of run out of energy? It stopped going?
It got feebler and feebler.
Huh.
So it got redshifted. So in other words, the wavelengths get stretched longer and longer until the light is so puny that it can't flip a pixel in your phone camera or anything.
Wow. So do you worry sometimes that everything we know is based on the machinery that we have, this brain, this sensory system, all of which evolved on an Earth for very particular reasons, and so we don't really have the capacity to even understand whole systems that are beyond the Earth because we weren't evolved to understand them?
Well, Einstein said the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible, and he's partly correct in that it is partly comprehensible. I think I could easily imagine a universe which was so fantastically complicated that the kinds of reasoning tools that we evolved to avoid saber-toothed tigers wouldn't be adequate. But one of the great miracles is that there are some simplicities in there which we can find ourselves. And that is a great source of comfort, in a way, that we are very small beings in a very large universe. And in many ways, we're just impotent, and we can't get along with each other. But it is remarkable that we have been able to find some principles that seem to, in way, to explain the universe in ways which we can cross-check, that make predictions in other areas which can be verified. So the high-energy physicists are all wringing their hands now because the Higgs boson is exactly as it was expected. So they wanted something cool and new to explore, but in fact the predictions were so good that it's lived up exactly to what they thought it would be.
But how much of this, and we're going to get to the Higgs boson in the next segment, so we promised to talk a little bit more about that, but how much of that is just because we frame everything within the capacities that we have? So we keep telling ourselves these stories over and over again, but always in the language, always in the vernacular of what we're capable of. So yeah, it met our prediction. Well, guess where the prediction came from? The mind that's doing the exploration and the questioning.
But the way we test the prediction is by with giant pieces of hardware and piece and electronics and things that behave in ways that we didn't plan, that we learned by hard, brutal experimentation. So that's the fact that you can do an experiment and find something is. It's possible to disappear into a pit of solipsism, but any high energy or any experimental physicist knows from slaving away with equipment that the equipment has a mind of its own. Not under our it's not under our governance.
My guest this hour is Stephen Reynolds, a professor of physics at NC State University, and our conversation continues in a moment. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Stephen Reynolds, professor of physics at NC State University. You mentioned the Higgs boson earlier, the so-called God particle. Why is this important? Give us the sketch, the Higgs boson.
Okay, well, as we fought through a thicket of experimental data from big particle accelerators in the 60s and 70s, there suddenly became a moment of clarity when people realized that these vast numbers of new particles that were being generated could all be produced out of a very small number of fundamental constituents, which we now call quarks that make up the protons and neutrons and most of the mass in our bodies, and leptons, of which the electron is the most famous. And there's a finite number of those. There's six quarks and six leptons. And the mathematics that describes how these things interact is only partially complete. But in some areas, it is fantastically accurately tested, and that seems to extend pretty well to the whole picture. And this picture is called the standard model of particle physics, and it explains a set of things. One of the things that it didn't explain in a while is why particles have mass, why they resist acceleration, why doesn't everything zip around at the speed of light like a photon, and a number of theoretical physicists in the 1960s came up with related conjectures. The one who managed to get his name stuck on it is Peter Higgs, a Scotch physicist. Somebody has a principle that nothing is named after the real discoverer, but I can't remember the name of the principle. So that's
yeah.
So the idea was that if there were an additional manifestation of a field, which is, that is to say, just something that's everywhere. In particle physics, fields can manifest themselves at specific locations as particles. So when you say what we really talk about is the Higgs field, that it's a kind of molasses that fills all space that different particles feel subject to in different ways. And one that feels it a lot is going to have very sluggish motion and a large mass. And one that barely feels it at all is going to move quite quickly and have a low mass. So this idea could be elaborated rigorously mathematically. And it was basically the last piece to make the standard model a completely consistent description of matter. And so it's, as we learned more about the other particles, we got a better and better idea of what the properties of the Higgs would have to be like, in particular, what it would fall apart into. It would have an extremely short lifetime, and it would decay into other things which could be studied. And by the time we add the MOXIE to make a gigantic particle accelerator and smash enough things into each other to find these traces that were predicted by George. There it was.
And it is fascinating because we don't think about it in these terms, but I mean, essentially, and you just jump right in and correct me when I'm wrong here, but we have essentially matter and force. There's the way things respond, and then there's the thing. And your question, well, why isn't everything just like light? Why does it suddenly get weight and get slowed down and become stuff that we can see and touch? And as I understand it, it passes through something, goes through a process, and a field is one of the things that a particle of matter could go through and transform. And am I sort of onto it there?
Well, different things can happen. I mean, you can think of all of the protons in the universe as a field. Different things can happen to a particle because of the interactions. So you can describe these on a continuous basis. For instance, electromagnetic forces or electromagnetic phenomena like light, you can think about that as being a field that at every point in the studio, I could get a little meter and I could measure the strength of the electric field. But I could also think of this room as being full of photons, full of particles. So either picture works pretty well. So whenever a particle does something, it's doing more or less what you say. It's interacting with some field and something's happening to it. So a very energetic photon can, if it's got enough energy, it can, in passing by an atom, it can split and become an electron and a positron. That's one thing that can happen. So the whole picture of particle physics is this vast grab bag of these kinds of interactions of a relatively small number of fields and a relatively small number of forces, four to be exact. There's the strong force that holds the nuclei together. When I was in elementary school, I wondered, how could you have the nucleus of an oxygen atom? It's got all these protons and neutrons, and they're all positively charged. And didn't they teach me that positive charges repelled? Well, my elementary school teacher, bless her heart, couldn't answer that question. And now we say it's because there's a strong force, but we actually have an idea what that is. It's basically the force between the quarks in those protons that is a very strong short-range force. There's the electromagnetic force, there's gravitation, and there's the weak force. And so four forces, six quarks, six leptons, the Higgs boson, we have a picture. Now, the astronomers have been chuckling a little bit at the physicists saying, well, we now have a complete picture because there's always been some bugs in it. For one thing, the universe is not equally matter and antimatter. We're one kind and not the other kind. And that is already says that there's something beyond the standard model that made when the universe at an incredibly early age was all energy, why didn't it just produce equal amounts? Why not? Well, that's something that's beyond the standard model. So there are already some areas we know there are chinks, and physicists are not going to run out of things to think about anytime soon.
Well, that answers the next question, which is the fear that somehow having discovered the Higgs boson, that all the mystery had gone out. In physics, there was, you know, you can fold up your tent and go home now.
Well, the problem, the questions will never go away. One thing that may go away is our resources to design the equipment to study them. I mean, the LHC is already basically a global enterprise, and I can imagine maybe at the outside, two more generations of superparticle accelerators, unless we think of some much cheaper and more compact way of doing this. So at that point, when we can't do our own experiments, we would never be able to find the Higgs boson by any kind of natural observation. But, of course, astronomy will continue to pose interesting new questions. Even there, though, we're spending a lot of money on the James Webb Space Telescope follow-on to Hubble, which will be bigger and optimized for infrared wavelengths and study things at the very beginnings of the universe. There, too, there'll be a limit to the largest telescope we can make. So I think it's not so much that we'll ever run out of questions, but we certainly may run out of the tools it'll take to address them.
Well, you know, there's ongoing debate about the nature of this kind of research, who should pay for it. The debate brought home in this state over higher education. The governor says, hey, look, if you can't prove that you've got some outcome and that you're going to pay for it when you get a job and it's a practical job, we don't want to pay for it. Why are we paying for liberal educations when, in fact, we need to look at this like a business person? Cost benefit. What's the value? Value of this education to me as a state. I mean, when you hear that kind of talk, is that right? Should we say to you as a particle physicist or as an astronomer, hey, what's in it for me? You know, you're having a great time. What do I get out of this stuff?
Well, it's absolutely an excellent question. I'm paid by taxpayer dollars, and I have to have an answer to that question. So one of the things I say is that actually what I teach at NC State is physics. We're a physics department. All of us teach a number of courses. Once in a while, I teach an astronomy course, but I primarily teach physics majors. And a few of those study, work in research in astrophysics. Very few of them go on to become professional astronomers. But the ones who work for us gain an abiding interest in learning how things work and obtaining the tools to do it. That's one of the great bait-and-switch schemes is to sucker people into science with things like astronomy and astrophysics. And once they're in there, give them technical tools which will enable them to do all kinds of problems. So that's one answer. Another answer is taking a long view. Let's imagine everybody's employed. Let's imagine somehow we eradicate poverty. Everybody has a good job. What are we going to do with our time? What are the most elevated things that you can imagine human beings doing? And one of the things is asking questions about the nature of our universe. And these are questions I mentioned earlier that I think really come home to people. People spend a lot of effort in genealogy to find out who their ancestors were a few generations back. Well, what about taking it back to our ancestors of the primates and our ancestors of the first multicell organisms, or even the ancestor atoms that make our bodies? These are the kinds of questions that human beings have always asked and that a small number of us are privileged enough to address.
Do you worry about the level of discourse and the nature of some of the critiques coming from the highest offices in the state now? It's taking a business approach, which is a quarter-by-quarter analysis. It doesn't take a long view. Are you worried that that can in any way have an impact on funding?
Well, I am concerned. As an educator, I think that my responsibility is to prepare students for a lifetime. Not necessarily, I don't want them to be completely unqualified to have any entry-level job, but I have to educate them so that they can find a job, that they can change jobs if necessary, that as the job changes, as 6 months from now when the technology they learned is obsolete, that they'll be able to learn something new, that they will have productive lives as citizens. And that's, I think, a surprising number of corporations feel the same way. Now, I'm not sure their HR departments do, but the CEOs certainly do. If you ask CEOs what kinds of employees they want, they tend to want the larger picture. And now I would like to see that philosophy a little bit more implemented at the immediate hiring level.
There is a fascinating bit of science, a place called the Goldilocks Zone, that I'd like to know more about. Apparently the Goldilocks Zone has to do with interplanetary or the discovery of other planets outside of our solar system. Tell us about the Goldilocks Zone.
Well, I'll begin by expressing astonishment that the incredible explosion in our discovery of extrasolar planets hasn't made more of an impression. And this is the kind of thing that when I was growing up would have been absolute gold to find real planets around other systems. Now, we can't take pictures of them in the way that you naively might like to, so the evidence is still relatively indirect. But now there are hundreds, perhaps thousands, of other planets around other stars. Some stars seem to have multiple planet systems. The Goldilocks zone is that region in which a planet could orbit its star, in which water could be a liquid. That's not just water chauvinism on our part, but it seems pretty necessary on general grounds that if there's going to be life, it's going to need a fluid basis. Gases and solids are just not going to cut it. Furthermore, water is a wonderful material. It dissolves almost anything. You think about it, water is an incredibly corrosive agency. We're just so used to it. But then any given star, stars have different types and different temperatures. So for a particular star, there is a region within which a planet could orbit and have liquid water. So one of the things you rule out, by the way, is very elliptical orbits of planets. And amazingly enough, that doesn't seem to be common. Somehow, the interaction of the gas cloud that gives rise to a planetary system seems to wind up producing relatively circular orbits. So some stars have quite a narrow habitability zone. Others have a larger one. On the other hand, you presumably want your star to have a long lifetime so that it isn't dead by the time your bacteria can get going. So for all these reasons, we think that stars, well, we know one case where life has been produced, a star of spectral class G, and now there are really
hundreds. Wait a minute, where is this now? We got life in another galaxy?
I didn't say another.
Right here?
Right here.
Yeah, well, you were talking about
our sun is spectral class G.
It did it once. And, well, I think maybe that answers your question. You say you were surprised. I think for those of us who didn't know enough about science, it would be preposterous to believe a universe this big wouldn't have other solar systems. I mean, we can't imagine another star not having planets somewhere, maybe not life, but why wouldn't there be another solar system?
Well, that's a long way from there to actually demonstrating their existence. So that's there are a lot of things that people have prejudices like that for, and for good reasons, but data always win.
So now, and it's actually relatively recently that we've been able to prove that there are other solar systems in the universe, right?
That's right. Basically, what it took was incredibly precise instrumentation. It was simply the improvement of our ability to measure tiny velocities of stars so that we could start measuring the minuscule wobble that a star feels when it's tugged by a planet going around it. So Jupiter tugs on our sun and causes it to move back and forth by, I forget what it is, it's like, I don't know, 10 meters per second, it's about the speed you could walk. So it's just amazing that we can detect this in other stars. Then there's a spacecraft, the Kepler spacecraft, crippled at the moment, unfortunately, which had the simple idea of just looking at many millions of stars, hoping to catch the tiny dimming of a star when a planet passed across the face. We can't resolve that, can't make a picture of it. But if you observe enough stars, you're going to catch a few. And it turned out a lot more than a few showed this property. So now we've got evidence of the planets passing in front of the stars. We can even begin to do some primitive spectral analysis and learn something about the planet's atmospheres. It's just an explosion.
You know, you talked about, again, being surprised at that most where we find other planets, they're pretty regular orbits. But wouldn't it be true if they were too wild and if they were too elliptical that they essentially disintegrate, they fall apart because they're irregular? It's precisely the regularity that caused that star to have a solar system or planets around it.
That's a very shrewd remark. If something is very short-lived, you're not likely to catch it. So if round orbits are more stable, then they'll be around a long time and your odds of finding one will be much better. So that's certainly part of the story.
So what's the most exciting thing for you on the horizon? What is it that you're hoping to do? If you could just go to the lab and go to your computer screen right now and see the answer, what would it be?
Oh, gosh, that's a tough question. Well, I'm involved with a hard X-ray imaging mission, the first satellite that can actually make pictures of higher energy X-rays. And just last week, it studied the remnant of the most recent supernova in our galaxy, which I have to admit that I and my colleagues discovered a few years ago. And we're just fascinated watching this thing. So those data are going to be descending to my computer any day now. And there's just a whole slew of information that may provide about the kinds of material in the star that exploded, and also about the way that cosmic rays seem to be manufactured in the remnants of supernovae.
When you get the answer to that, we'll have you back.
I'll be glad to come.
Stephen Reynolds, thank you so much for talking with us. Stephen Reynolds is a professor of physics at NC State University, specializing in astrophysics and relativity. That's our program. Thanks so much for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.